Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, two brief talks by Chris Hedges on the bad results of empire. Bad not just abroad, but at home. I hope you'll stay tuned. Here's one thing to keep in mind about empire, in mine humble opinion. Empire is not mainly about national glory. Empire and imperialism is about grabbing other people's natural resources in order to enrich the commercial and financial interests at home. The foreign country ends up poorer, and the imperial country ends up richer. Or rather, the rich and powerful commercial interests of the imperial country end up richer. In fact, the citizens of the imperial country end up poorer too, and a good deal less free than they had been back when their country had been a republic, back before it metastasized into an empire. The citizens are worse off. This happened in Rome back when, and it is happening even as we speak in the United States today. Journalist and essayist Chris Hedges has been elaborating on these ideas a good deal recently. We'll hear selections from a couple of recent talks he gave. Let's start with part of an interview with Hedges by Sonali Kolhatkar, February 9, 2015. As we pick up, Hedges talks about President Obama and the people more powerful than him that Obama actually works for. This leads to remarks on how empires repress the people at home, starting with the marginalized people, but not stopping there. Hedges ends with an interesting comparison of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Late in his life, King came to understand the destructiveness of empire at home, Hedges thinks. But Malcolm learned and proclaimed this truth much earlier. Here are Chris Hedges with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Well, because he works for them, they don't work for him. And that's true in terms of his inability to regulate or control Wall Street, to stem the gross and evisceration of our most basic constitutional rights, including the right to privacy, and in terms of the war machine. You go back a few decades and you had at least a wing of the Democratic Party, Proxmire, McGovern, others, who would challenge, these monstrous procurement programs and spending programs within the military. That doesn't exist anymore. The military gets whatever it wants. And that's because the corporate state and its armed wing, the U.S. military, which in essence does its bidding, is beyond control. And that's very frightening. So Obama can say whatever he wants. And I certainly applaud him for saying it and not buying into this kind of rabid Christian right war against Islam, but at the same time, he's unable in any way to effectively curtail, stem, regulate, or control the major institutions that have power, including the war industry.
Chris, do you see a connection between our foreign policy that targets brown, poor people in countries like Iraq and our domestic policy here in the United States that sees African Americans and people of color as the biggest targets of state police violence?
Yes. What happens when empires decline, this is true for all empires, is that the harsher forms of control on the outer reaches of empire migrate back to the center of empire because empires hollow themselves out from the inside. You can see it through crumbling infrastructure, the increasing impoverishment, now half the country living in either poverty or near poverty, the assault on public education, on public services. And so as the empire essentially disintegrates from within, the forms of control, the violent forms of control that are used to maintain empire's borders, become the tools that are used to maintain internal control. So that's why you see drones, police and law enforcement officials now using drones. It's why you see wholesale surveillance. It's why you see militarized police forces. It's why you see a range of laws that have taken away our most cherished civil liberties. And, you know, as you know, I sued Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, won in the Southern Court, and then they appealed it, and the decision was overturned. But, you know, that is a law that allows the U.S. military to seize American citizens who are deemed to be terrorists in the eyes of the state, strip them of due process, and hold them indefinitely in military facilities. Absolutely terrifying. So yes, there is a complete correlation. And what's happened with the so-called war on drugs is that, and this is what, you know, it's the marginal communities who always suffer first. They went into these marginal communities and created police states where law enforcement officials are beyond control. They can kick down your door. They can stop you at random. And then they stack you with all sorts of charges. 94% of those who are charged with crimes in this country never even get inside a courtroom. They have to plea out. They'll stack you with 18, 19 charges, very few of which you committed, and they use that as a kind of bargaining chip. And then, you know, on top of it, we are seeing increasing examples of a kind of extortion where, as part of that plea deal, they have to sign agreements that they won't appeal. So this is what Hannah Arendt writes about when she talks about the creation within totalitarian states of omnipotent police forces who go after a particular segment of a society, in her case, stateless Jews, who are stripped of their rights. But then as soon as a society or you know, a despotic government needs that mechanism for control against the wider population, they not only have the legal basis for it, but they have the physical infrastructure with which to carry it out. So, yeah, there's a kind of horrible convergence between the crimes that are committed abroad and the crimes that are committed at home. And, you know, we haven't even spoken about the effects of climate change, the fact that the speculation on Wall Street is ultimately not sustainable. That, you know, they all know what's coming and they're preparing. And with a flick of a switch, it's the iron fist.
Chris, you also wrote about Malcolm X recently on the 50th anniversary of his assassination, saying that it was he rather than King who got it right on the issue of the inner workings of empire. How so? I mean, King did talk about economic justice.
Yes, but King believed that, in essence, America had a conscience, or at least that was part of his public campaign. I think you could argue that at the end of King's life, he essentially understood, like Malcolm, that empire has no conscience. But I think Malcolm, because he came out of a very different milieu, you know, he grew up on the streets, he was in foster homes, he dropped out of school when he was 15, he was in prison. He understood in a way that King, who grew up, in essence, in the upper middle class, didn't, the heartlessness of empire, that empire exists to exploit and repress what Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth at home and abroad. And that we were never going to appeal to that, the better angels of those who orchestrated that empire. That it was only with the dismantling or destruction of empire that we could begin to talk about not only racial justice, but any kind of real liberty or justice at home and overseas. And Malcolm got it. And Malcolm was right about America. And I think certainly by the last year of King's life, if not earlier, King got it as well. The crimes of empire, which go all the way back to when we began empire, essentially we colonized our own in terms of indigenous communities, then went on the Spanish-American War, etc. The crimes of empire finally come back to haunt those who maintain empire. And that's precisely what we're seeing. If we don't wake up to what empire is, the nature of empire itself, which is about the commodification of human beings, turning human beings into objects, the constant exploitation. And this is why Sacco and I, Joe Sacco, did our book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, where we went into the sacrifice zones, the poorest pockets of the United States, and said, look, here's what unfettered, unregulated capitalism does when it has no checks, because we're all about to become one huge sacrifice zone. So, yeah, I think Malcolm was far more prescient on that issue throughout his life than King was.
Hedges explored many of these same themes a few months earlier in a nice talk he gave in Newark, New Jersey, October 9, 2014. He spoke to an organization of community activists, the People's Organization for Progress. He spoke about police brutality and mass incarceration. Hedges sees police excesses and overflowing prisons as racist. But more than just that, police brutality and mass incarceration have a purpose. And that purpose is the crushing of all dissent and opposition to the system. And the more the declining empire buckles under its own unsustainable weight, the more brutal it becomes in crushing dissent at home. Hedges' analysis is backed up by his experience in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and in his experience teaching courses inside the state prisons in New Jersey. Speaking in Newark, here again is Chris Hedges.
One of the main instruments of social control became, of course, mass incarceration and the use of the drug laws, the excuse of drug laws, by which especially poor men of color whose bodies were worth nothing on the streets of Newark behind bars are suddenly worth $40,000 or $50,000 to phone companies. And I just tried to send money to a friend of mine through a commissary, and you know, they passed it all now to this private company. If you send $20, they want $5. Every single way that they can gouge the poor, the prison in Rahway. If a relative of yours dies, you can go either have a deathbed visit or the wake for 15 minutes, but they charge you $800. Did you know that? $800. If you're earning $1 a day, think how long it takes to pay off $800. You pay that $800 for those two guards to go shackled for 15 minutes. You got to pay them $800. This is something that undocumented workers are experiencing. ICE just uses undocumented workers like an ATM machine because they have zero rights. So they will pick them up for fines that if you are a citizen, might not even have a fine, but they have a whole different fine system. And these are some of the poorest people in the country. $1,000 for driving without a license, whatever it is. And they're going to be deported, but they kind of loot as much money as they can from them on the way out the door. What is it that we've created, essentially through the power to create police forces in cities like Newark, Camden, wherever it is, that are omnipotent? By omnipotent, meaning they've essentially been given the legal right to serve as judge, jury, and executioner. Mm. There's a political philosopher I like very much named Hannah Arendt who writes in her book, Origins of Totalitarianism, about precisely this issue. She had fled Nazi Germany as a Jew to France. Once she fled Nazi Germany, she was stripped of her German citizenship, so she became, on the eve of World War II, that large group of people who were defined as stateless, meaning they had no legal documents, in the same way that undocumented workers in this country are stateless, and therefore the systems of authority, and in particular the judicial systems and the systems of law enforcement, can do whatever they want with them. So she wrote about what happened when you create these omnipotent policing forces that are able to prey on groups of people who essentially have been stripped of their rights, either because they're poor and they live in communities like Newark, or because they're undocumented. And she said that what happens is that once you create the physical mechanism of omnipotent policing, the ability of the police, as you all know, to kick down your doors in the middle of the night, supposedly delivering a warrant for a nonviolent offense, that, when it's twinned with the corruption of the legal system, essentially becomes a recipe for totalitarianism. So what we've seen over the last few years is an evisceration of our most basic constitutional rights. Wholesale surveillance, everybody in this room, every form of electronic communication we have is captured, downloaded, and stored by the government. We are the most photographed, monitored, watched, eavesdropped population in human history. And I covered the East German state, the Stasi. I covered it as a reporter. I covered the collapse of East Germany and the kinds of things that the state is able to do to us now, the Stasi never even dreamt of. Wow. And all of this stuff is stored in perpetuity in government computers. Why? And again, we go back to a writer on totalitarianism. She said that in totalitarian systems, the reason they take and capture all of your information and store it is not essentially because they are looking for a crime. It's because at the moment that they seek to criminalize an entire class of people. They have enough information on you that they can seize and pick whatever they want to use it to justify incarceration and detention. And so this system of mass surveillance, which looks benign, relatively, in a period of relative stability, in a period of instability, becomes a potent weapon in the hands of the state by which you can essentially round up and crush any forms of legitimate dissent. And we've already seen that with the Occupy movement. Again, just as the drug laws essentially were used to create the physical presence of militarized, omnipotent policing, the laws ostensibly passed against Islamic terrorism gave the state the ability to create a legal structure by which a citizen can be instantly stripped of all of their rights. So one of the things that we've seen, and I was very involved in the Occupy movement, one of the things we've seen with Occupy activists is that because they communicated electronically, the state knows who they are. They know who's important and who isn't. And we have seen the state, since the closure of the Zuccotti Occupy encampment, go back and, because I was involved, I know that they've got the right people. They know exactly who to target. They know who are the engines behind movements like that, because they were communicating electronically. And so what they've done to essentially, and this gets right back to essentially what's happening in inner cities, is they've used felony convictions to essentially neutralize activists. And the way they do it, they charge you, in the same way they do in a community like Newark, they charge you with a bunch of crimes for which you can go to jail for a long period of time, very few, if any, that you actually committed, but that, of course, doesn't matter. The point is to force you to plea out. And I'll give you an example. One of the activists that I worked with, really interesting guy, by the way, he had gone to Columbia University on a football scholarship and had gotten quite injured in a game his freshman year, started tutoring up in Harlem, kind of awoke his consciousness. He ended up dropping out of Columbia, went back to California, became an activist, ended up finishing his degree at Berkeley. He was in the park. He was a very important figure, there from the first day, part of the Direct Action Committee. And what they did is the cops arrested him when he had a pair of scissors in his hand, and they charged him with assault with a deadly weapon against a New York City police officer, which was a mandatory sentence of 7 years. Now, what I love about this is they had a platform, if any of you were at Zuccotti, where they filmed 24 hours a day.
Right.
But, of course, they didn't happen to have film of this because it didn't happen. So they bring him up in the court. Initially, the defense attorney wants a plea agreement, and the prosecutor says, we're not going to offer a plea because he's on the homeland terrorism list.
Wow.
They eventually let him plea if he accepted a felony conviction with 5 years probation. That's exactly what they do. And that's what they do. You know, so many of my students in the prison system, you know, the prosecutor is kind of selling them on this deal, but they don't understand the consequences of having a felony conviction on their record, even if they'd never spent a day in jail or a day in prison. And that is the way that they have been steadily using this form of electronic surveillance to neutralize activists. So much of what's happening in inner city environments, such as Camden, such as Newark, and others, are now being replicated in the wider society. And it is through the use of the so-called war on drugs and the so-called war on terror, which give the state the kind of excuse to strip us of any kind of judicial or legal protection. And we've seen this in my own case that I sued Barack Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act in the Southern District Court in New York. Section 1021 permits the U.S. military, this overturns over 150 years of domestic law, permits the U.S. military to seize American citizens who, in the language of this section, substantially support Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces. Now, substantially support is not a legal term. It's not material support. It's open to wide interpretation. And what are associated forces? To hold them in military facilities, strip them of due process, and keep them there indefinitely, in the language of that section, until the end of hostilities. All of this is important because you have an evisceration of the legal system, which the kind of bellwether, the canary in the coal mine, began with poor communities, where people of color, and let's talk in terms of Marx, essentially superfluous labor. They moved manufacturing overseas so they could pay sweatshop workers in Bangladesh 22 cents an hour and exploit them in a form of neo-slavery, in essence, which is what capitalists do. And so all these people who had manufacturing jobs in places like Newark, Trenton was a big... Camden used to be a huge manufacturing center. Campbell Soup, RCA, 36,000 people used to work in that port. They've suddenly got all this superfluous labor. The question is, how are they going to make money off of this labor? The way they make money off of this labor is the business of mass incarceration. That's it. It's a big business. That's all it is. I forget your name again. Earl, who should probably be up here talking, not me. But, I mean, Earl can tell you, the stories you hear inside those prisons would just rip your heart out. Story after story. Nobody gets a fair hearing. The system, as a matter of fact, the people who usually have the longest sentences are the ones who went to trial. Because they got to pressure you to plea out. If everybody goes to trial, the system's going to collapse. So if you go to trial, which often are the people who kind of, especially if they're young, they're kind of naive. Well, I didn't do it. I mean, I got a guy from Elizabeth. He was 5 years on the U.S. Army boxing team. Incredible guy. Comes back to Elizabeth out of the Army, and he's training to go pro, to be a professional boxer. And he gets picked up. It's the typical thing where they stack him full of all sorts of charges for crimes he didn't commit. They offer him a 16-month plea. He said, okay, plea out. He goes, I didn't do it. And I'm not going to plea out because if I spend 16 months sitting in a jail cell, I'm finished. It'll take me 2 years to get back to this level and, you know, become a boxer. Plus, he's going to be 2 years older. So he goes to court, and they give him a 30-year sentence. He's sitting in Rahway. I got a guy in Rahway. He's 39 now. He was arrested in Camden when he was 14 years old. There was a knifing. It was part of a gang. He goes, I was 90 pounds. He may have been there. I'm pretty certain he didn't do it. So they take a 14-year-old boy, they haul him into the police station in Camden, and they won't let his mother come in until 2 in the morning. The kid's crying. He just wants to go home. He's 14 years old. He signs a confession. That's how it works. Sign it, you go home. He's 14. No lawyer, no mother, no guardian, no nothing. He's put in with the adult population at 14. He is not eligible to go before a parole board till he's 70. There's story after story like that. And of course, you're marked once you get out. No food stamps, no public account. I don't have to tell anyone in the room that. So that the system essentially perpetuates itself. And one of the things that's interesting as we see the breakdown of the wider society is that white people, beginning with white poor people who had ignored this as an issue, are now getting picked up in rural communities largely on meth and being treated the way people of color have been treated for several decades. And that goes right back to Hannah Arendt. Once you create these systems, they become insidious. As the wider society devolves, the legal structure is eviscerated. You always look for the excuse. You know, Muslim terrorists become the excuse by which we're all supposed to give up all of our civil liberties. Drug dealers, drug people, they've always got an excuse. But once you normalize that kind of activity, coupled with the economic evisceration that has happened, where you have created essentially an oligarchic system, a global oligarchic elite, where none of these guys pay taxes. They have committed massive amounts of fraud and criminal activity. That's not an accusation. That's a documented fact. And yet they never go to jail, ever. Now, the danger of this is that, and we'll go back to Marx, because there are no internal limits in terms of unregulated capitalism, because it will continue to exploit and exploit and exploit. The only thing unfettered capitalists understand is more. Because they have no internal limits, then eventually there's going to be some kind of blowback, both in terms of the effects of climate change. I mean, the fossil fuel industry determine our relationship to the ecosystem, and anybody who reads climate change reports is probably as terrified as I am. One of the last ones being that the biosphere is no longer capable of absorbing the CO2 emissions and everything else, coupled with this recreation of the neo-feudal economy, a world where you have an oligarchic elite and two-thirds of the country hanging on by their fingertips, crippled by debt peonage. Debt peonage, of course, has always been an effective form of social control. It's the way, after emancipation, black people were kept in slavery by another name. Debt peonage, we have loaded that up on our young. The largest personal debt in the country, $1 trillion, are these kids who graduated from college. And look what our government has done. If you declare bankruptcy, it doesn't affect your student loans. How thoughtful of the Congress to pass this law. Not only that, but you pay an interest rate that is actually higher than the bank interest rate.
Wow.
So these kids get out of college, they're hit with $600, $700, $800 a month, often, and they, of course, can't find a job. That is what, of course, triggered the Occupy movement. And I think one of the things that is so painful is teaching in a place like Rahway or Trenton this summer and running into these individuals who are so brilliant, have so much integrity, have so much to offer to the wider society, and are just sitting behind bars for decades, unheralded, unappreciated, and even reviled by the wider community.
Chris Hedges, speaking in Newark, New Jersey. We heard parts of two talks explaining how empires destroy not only their colonial subjects abroad, but also their own citizens at home. Thanks to Uprising Radio for our first selection, and thanks to Building Bridges, your community and labor report, for the second. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, urging you to keep the aspidistra flying, illegitimate non-carborundum, and please try to speak truth to power. Power probably won't listen to you, but others might. Until next week, then, peace.